At the inauguration, Obama's oldies.
Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America.
Nothing's impossible, I have found. When my chin is on the ground, I pick myself up, dust myself off, start all over again.
Obama quoted a 1936 Dorothy Fields Jerome Kern song from a Fred Astaire movie that came out in the middle of the Great Depression. Fred and Ginger dancing our way through the next 4 years. What am I supposed to do again?
Pick myself up, dust myself off, start all over again.
Got it. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 21st, 2009, and it is an uplifting beat.
Yes.
And it's kind of nice that you've told us where that line came from.
Right. Yeah. Good morning, Ginger.
Good morning, Fred, and good morning to you, everyone. Today is day one for President Barack Obama. And he's already gotten to work. We're going to talk about the market turmoil today. And we also are going to hear about some Americans heading home after witnessing history. Those stories are coming up. But first, these headlines.
A busy first night on the job for the president and first lady. They made appearances at 10 inaugural balls. At the Commander-in-Chief Ball, President Obama heard from a group of Chicago natives stationed in Afghanistan via satellite.
Good morning, sir. Specialist Giovanna Guerra from Chicago, Illinois, Hyde Park to be exact, and I am a Sox fan.
Hey! Finally! It's about time.
Nice. All the others were Cub fans. The president added that fans of all teams can salute the military's service and sacrifice. The president was able to get some work done between the parade and the parties. One of his first executive acts was to halt all pending regulations from the Bush administration, and he also suspended military trials at Guantanamo Bay for the next 120 days.
Today's schedule is just as packed. President Obama is attending a prayer service at the National Cathedral in just about half an hour. Then he's hosting an open house at his new home. Later on, he has meetings on the economic stimulus bill and the situations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Not all of his cabinet members will be able to help out right away, that is. The Senate approved 6 members, but postponed a vote on Secretary of State nominee Hillary Clinton. Republican Senator John Cornyn demanded a debate first. She's still expected, though, to be approved. Outgoing President Bush greeted supporters in Midland, Texas yesterday on his way home. He says he's ready to stay a while.
I am grateful that you all came out to welcome us home. And I am thankful that I had the honor of being the President of the United States for 8 years.
President Bush's plans include working on a book and setting up his presidential library in Dallas.
It's not a coloring book, we understand. The Israeli military says they're all out of Gaza. Troops remain gathered on the Israeli side of the border. Shares on Wall Street fell sharply yesterday as the new president took power. The Dow fell more than 4%. Asian markets declined about 2% this morning. And Wall Street is poised to open up slightly. Good morning. You have a new president. What does President Obama need to focus on first? We want your suggestions. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coloring book. That was beyond the pale. That was. I'll probably get called on that one.
It was very funny, though. I laughed. I think it was funny. You were being humorous.
Watch that stuff.
That's okay. You can be humorous.
It's over now. All right. Thank you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As we've noted many times on this program, the new president, Barack Obama, faces a giant workload as the serious problems in the economy and in foreign affairs come now directly to his desk. He faces some very harrowing deadlines in the early going, which means he has to deal with Congress and world leaders at a very rapid pace. And for a look at all of these challenges and the schedule of those challenges, we're joined by New York Times' David Sanger. He's chief Washington correspondent for The Times, and his new book, The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. are is basically the question we're asking all of you today. What do you think Barack Obama should be putting at the top of his list on day one? David, thanks for joining us.
Good to be back with you, John.
You know, we've said continually since Election Day that, boy, this day was going to be some serious sort of first day at work. But what are the kind of calendar dates in the early going that Barack Obama really needs to look carefully at on the economy and in foreign affairs as you see it?
Well, you know, the thing about being president is rarely do things go the way the calendar would put it together. But let's look at a couple. The economic issues are run to some degree by the calendar. For example, the auto bailout that started with the end of the Bush administration, by the mid to end of March, the Detroit automakers have to come through with a plan for viability that passes the laugh test, because if they don't, they can't get the next tranche of money or negotiate out what that would be. And then you're into an unemployment situation that is significantly worse than anything we see today. On the case of Congress, they approved in the last days of the Bush administration all of the rest of the $750 billion. That's the good news. The bad news is that the Obamaites, as they were coming in, conceded that the first half of that was spent in a way that it didn't actually increase lending coming down to ordinary homeowners. So before they spend it, they've got to fix how they're spending it. And that process starts today. He's also meeting the Joint Chiefs today, and most of the inheritance is basically on the foreign policy challenges.
Before we go to the foreign policy for just one moment, on this issue of the spending of the stimulus package so that it helps homeowners, do they have to rewrite laws that were passed last year? Is this going to be new hearings, new Barney Frank negotiations, all of that?
Fortunately not, because for better or worse, the legislation was so porous in his writing, in the writing of it, that you'll remember that it was used initially for banks and then partly for those automakers and then, you know, for a number of other causes as well. So my guess is that they've got a fair bit of latitude about how to go spend it, although there are Republicans in Congress who are arguing that beyond the auto industry and the banking industry, it should not be used for industry-specific bailouts.
And, David, in terms of the bailout money, isn't it troubling that Barack Obama does not have a Treasury Secretary right now, and Tim Geithner, his nominee, is going into hearings today with a slight cloud over him?
It doesn't help, but frankly, both Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, the director of the National Economic Council, have been working to put together the strategy. And, you know, nobody can predict how hearings will go, but it strikes me that the problem that Geithner's run into, which was taxes that were unpaid because of a strange complication of what happens when you work for the International Monetary Fund, which Mr. Geithner did, they have been resolved. He paid the money before he got nominated, although not by much. And my suspicion is they'll give him a hard time and he'll pass.
Right. Well, the question is how many lawmakers are going to want to take a stand on this, or maybe wait till down the line. There'll be plenty of opportunities to take a stand on the foreign policy front. We've got Israel saying today that its military pullout from Gaza is complete, yet that situation is hardly resolved. What are the issues facing the president regarding stepping back into the Middle East?
Well, as I point out in the inheritance, the good news for President Obama is that the Gaza problem is the easy one. Doesn't that make you feel good already?
Yeah.
We revealed in the Times a week and a half ago that he is inheriting, along with President Bush's various policies, a number of covert actions, particularly about Iran, where the U.S. has started a new effort to try to undercut the Iranian nuclear program, and in Pakistan, where the president authorized last summer new ground incursions that would enable the U.S. to go over the border into sovereign Pakistani territory, an ally, remind you, to go after not only al-Qaeda but other insurgents.
Well, let me stop you there for one thing. I mean, on the one hand, Iran looks like it might be a reckless move, at least looking at Obama's rhetoric on Iran. He seems to be inclined to talk to Iran. But on the Pakistan side, it seems like something that would be very much something he would support, since he suggested he would cross the border to go after Osama bin Laden if he was in Pakistan.
I think you've got it exactly right, but they complicate his diplomacy in two ways. In the Iran case, it's a little bit difficult to say, I'm going to sit down and engage you for the first time without making it clear whether or not he will also proceed to undercut the nuclear program, although President Bush would argue that the covert action gives some steel to whatever conversations take place. In the Pakistani case, it's very difficult to go get the Pakistanis to go off and actually fight the war we want them to fight against the Taliban and the insurgents instead of the one we don't want them to fight against India, if they believe that we are deliberately violating what they view as their national sovereignty. So he's got some big calls to make that are a lot more complex than the way they were debated during the campaign.
All right,
just those two.
All right, but let's take those two for one second before we move on, and that is there something that simplifies these by virtue of the fact that Barack Obama is a figure, a world figure suddenly, and who knows how long it will last, way beyond the stature of really an American president since Ronald Reagan, in terms of being able to go over and say, all right, let's roll up our sleeves and do this fundamentally differently. He does have a moment here, and it might simplify some of the complexity that's bedeviled us for the last 8 years.
The good news is he does have a moment because there's a honeymoon period not only at home but abroad. However, with your and that particularly will work with our allies, particularly our European allies, who, as the British wrote in several articles that appeared in the past week, were looking to see the back of George Bush as he got onto that helicopter. With your enemies, however, or those who are potential enemies, they are going to try to test him because they view him as inexperienced. And they want to see just how much room they have. And you already saw the North Koreans doing this last week when they announced to a visiting American, somebody who's frequently there, a scholar named Sig Harrison, that they had already taken the nuclear fuel that they harvested during the first weeks of the Iraq War, actually, while George Bush was looking elsewhere, and weaponized them. That is, turned them into what they said were probably six weapons. Six or seven weapons. So there are moments you're going to see in the next few months where this new president will be tested, whether the first big test is over the Gaza, over Iran, over North Korea, or over an incursion into the Pakistani territories. I can't tell you, but I can tell you this. Each one of them is going to take a shot and see how he reacts.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about rollbacks then. Guantanamo, one of the first acts of Barack Obama was to announce that he wants to essentially roll back the Guantanamo Bay policy of detentions and this kind of netherworld of judicial policy regarding enemy combatants. Any other rollbacks you see in Iraq or elsewhere?
You'll see it on interrogation as well. On interrogation policy. But in the case of Guantanamo, I think what we'll see in the next week is the decision, you know, the written document on closing it down. But actually doing it is likely to take a year or more, just as they try to find homes for those 240 or 250 current inmates, some of whom are pretty hardened. On interrogation, you can turn that around right away. But you almost saw in those last moments where President Bush was saying, I kept you safe, that the subtext was, I'm just waiting for the first thing that goes wrong where we can sort of step in and say the old way worked.
All part of the inheritance. It's the title of David Sanger's book. Thanks for joining us. He's the chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. So, first full day on the job as president. Focus.
The number one concern are jobs, and if he gets that right, then the rest will follow.
What do you think Barack Obama needs to focus on today? And, of course, he has a lot to deal with on his first full day at work. Two wars, a sinking economy. Did anyone ask you to shovel out the stables on your first day on the job? What's the worst thing that happened to you on the job? 877-8-MY-TAKE. First days.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. First full day in the Oval Office. What should be on the top of the to-do list?
The new President Barack Obama should initially start by establishing a special prosecutor to investigate the Bush administration and all the harm that they did to our country.
Think about your first day on the job. What was the worst thing you had to deal with when you got there? What did you inherit from the previous person who sat at your desk? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And now we're going to take a look at a few minutes of the first minutes of his job as President of the United States of America. We're going to look at his speech because for weeks, speechwriters and politicians and pundits were trying to forecast what exactly he would say. What would he deliver in his inaugural address?
This is the meaning of our liberty and our creed, why men and women and children of every race and every faith can join in celebration across this magnificent mall, and why a man whose father less than 60 years ago might not have been served at a local restaurant can now stand before you to take a most sacred oath.
Joining us to take a look at the speech the president did make is David Wall Rice, an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Morehouse College. David is the principal investigator of a study organized by Morehouse College's Identity Status Lab that is looking at the election and its impact on black males. He usually joins us from Atlanta, but he was in Washington, D.C., and he joins us from there. Good morning, David.
Good morning, friends. How are you?
So tell us about your experience of being in the audience and listening to the speech. What was your overall sense of it?
Well, I thought the overall sense of it was that I thought it was adult and mature. I know that there are a lot of folks who were talking about it as being somber, but I really think that it was an example of not necessarily speaking truth to power, but speaking truth within power. So, you know, it was an adult. It was a leader of the free world, essentially, speaking to, you know, his citizens in a very mature and real way. So I give it a lot of credit.
He said, put away childish things, literally.
Absolutely.
And not only that, as you're saying, there was this intense theme of a strong America, but also this notion of accountability and optimism. Let's listen to another piece of it.
There are some who question the scale of our ambitions, who suggest that our system cannot tolerate too many big plans. Their memories are short, for they have forgotten what this country has already done, what free men and women can achieve when imagination is joined to common purpose and necessity to courage.
There's the optimism, David.
Sure, absolutely. And I think there was a mix. I mean, I think it was an even balance. I think that, you know, pardon my French, but I think it's an example of somebody who knows what the hell they're talking about. And so to have him there and to have him talking in a very real and true way was refreshing, you know, instead of, you know, this kind of spin, and it didn't seem like spin. It seemed like a mature speech that was meant to jumpstart a new America. So,
well, David, what was your reaction to his evocation of the Washington Valley Forge speech? I mean, you know, it's not often invoked, and he quotes it directly. And you know, I was just surprised that he went back way to the early days.
I thought it was really cool. I mean, I think that the entire speech brought in a lot of different pieces, but he really is, you know, he's really setting himself up as a patriot. It seemed like he loves this country and he knows the country. And what he's able to do is to bring these strands of history to the current so that we can remember what it is that we went through, so that we can address exactly what it is that's before us.
And so much of it was about inclusiveness. And watching the coverage yesterday, I was struck by how many people were moved by this part of his speech.
To the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect. To those leaders around the globe who seek to sow conflict
or blame their society's ills on the West. Know that your people will judge you on what you can build, not what you destroy.
There was a lot of discussions on the blogs, on television, about this one sentence where he reaches out to the Muslim world. What did you make of that?
Well, I think that what I made of it is that he's trying to explain that, you know, we're setting ourselves up for inclusion. And I think that what he's talking about is that for such a long time, because of the events of 9/11, there is this racist undercurrent. And I think that him talking about that, talking about Muslims, talking about the fact that, you know, we need to make sure that we're very honest about who and how we're interacting with one another. I think that he kind of pulled the sheet back from all of this murmuring that we know is going on. So I thought, again, I thought it was very adult. It was stepping right up to an issue and addressing it. And I think that it's kind of the elephant in the room in a lot of situations.
For you personally, David, as someone who studies speeches, who is a professor of psychology, what was the experience like for you?
Well, for me personally, you know, I thought it was great. I really believe the hype, you know, so I was there on the parade route and listening to the speech and, you know, had a chance to see him. And for me, the thing that made the speech so powerful was the response to it. You know, there were millions of folks who were in Washington, D.C., who paused. And there were many millions and millions of people around the world who stopped and paused and were very much vested in what this person had to say about what we were all going to do together. And so, you know, it meant a lot to me in reflecting on, you know, the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech and, you know, having not only my son and wife with me, but driving my mother down from Philadelphia. You know, there were a lot of generational intersections there that I really appreciated. And I think that, you know, the speech kind of lived up to, like I said, to the hype that had been presented for so many months leading up to this moment.
A true believer, David Walrice, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Takeaway contributor David Walrice is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Morehouse College in Atlanta. And now Mark Garrison has the latest headlines.
Thank you. It's 28 minutes after the hour. Just hours after taking over, President Obama ordered a stop to any regulations put in place in the last hours of the Bush administration. He wants a chance to review them before going forward. They include measures on abortion and gun control. As for former President George W. Bush, he's waking up this morning at his ranch in Crawford, Texas. He went there after rallies in two Texas cities. Around 3,000 supporters gathered at a Waco airfield to welcome him back to the state. And he got a little choked up, actually, at another rally in Midland, Texas.
One former president one time said it was bittersweet to leave Washington. You know, I guess I can understand it from his perspective, but for me, there's nothing to be bitter about. Today is some kind of sweet.
He gave us a little hint about what this morning would be like in his final press conference last week. He anticipated his agenda this morning would simply be making coffee for his wife and just taking it from there. So that's what his plans are.
Will the press corps show up for that?
I don't know. He probably would be happy to have him not be there.
I don't think he has a press corps anymore. I think Barack Obama, President Barack
news.
Obama,
yeah.
Has a press corps now.
Bob Woodward is there watching.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mark Garrison.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. President Barack Obama has a bursting plate on his first day, and it might just be a bad day for him. Maybe he'd appreciate hearing some of your worst first day on the job stories.
I had arrived in New York the night before from Atlanta, showed up at work, and apparently they hadn't told the guy who I was going to be replacing that I was going to be replacing him. And so they said that when he comes in, which he was scheduled to come in about half an hour, he's going to look at you kind of funny when you're sitting in his chair.
Oh. Okay, what are some of the worst things that have happened on your first day of the job? We want to hear it at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
So if the president is looking for a mess on his desk this morning, he need no look no further than the markets. They declined by a record amount for an inauguration day yesterday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average ended the day 4% down. The S&P even more, 5%. The markets are poised to bounce this morning. But here's a number for you. Since Election Day, the value of at least one bank stock, Citigroup, has gone down 89%, roughly hovering between 80 and 89% decline since Election Day. People who are watching the markets yesterday were suggesting it's not so much a fear of Barack Obama, but no one's had a chance in the financial world to look up from the fiasco that's happening all over the world. And here to talk about this is Dan Gross, senior editor for Newsweek. Dan, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, John.
It seems that let's talk about the banks first. It seems that there's a bit of a problem in the sort of bank bailout that relates to the fact that as the government takes a higher and higher stake in U.S. banks and acquires this preferred stock, the common stock of the banks begins to slide to zero. And I'm wondering if we're looking at a de facto nationalization of the banks simply because there's no other direction for it to go.
Absolutely. You know, there's been this very slow realization. I call, you know, 2008 was maybe the year of living cluelessly.
Nice.
Given the way the banks had set themselves up, you know, taking on all those liabilities, buying all those mortgage-backed securities and things they couldn't trade, and not having capital to back it up, they basically set themselves up to be worthless in the case of, you know, a widespread decline in the value of their assets. And that's basically what happened. It's just that the shareholders and the government have been very slow to just say, listen, your stock is worth zero. And, you know, the market, people think it's efficient, but it's not very efficient. The upshot of having the taxpayer come in and have to, you know, not only give you capital and take shares, and then, as in the case with Citi, have to come in and say, oh, here's $45 billion more, and, oh, by the way, we will backstop and guarantee further losses. That combined with the numbers they're posting, you know, the losses they're seeing on things like consumer credit cards, corporate loans, et cetera, you know, there's not much there.
The losses are staggering, or at least when you read them, there's certainly cause for great concern. And Dan, I'm just wondering, given all of this paralyzing fear about the value of banks, why not just buy up all of the bad assets and set them aside in some other kind of organization?
Well, that's part of the, you know, conversation that's been happening. There's this talk of creating the so-called bad bank. Of course, if you put all the assets in the bad bank, there wouldn't be all that much of a good bank left. And, you know, in Britain, they've gone a little more direct. They have gone to sort of full, almost straight nationalization of some of their biggest lenders who failed, because it's a more efficient, realistic thing to do. You know, the question is, the shareholders of Citigroup, who have, as you noted, lost 80-90% of their value, the managers of Citigroup, they don't want nationalization because they know that that would probably do away with their jobs and any hope of recouping value from these shares. But given what they're asking the taxpayer to do, which is to, you know, provide cash now and backstop billions and billions of potential losses that are far in excess of Citigroup's market value, it's worth about $15 billion.
Right.
On the open market today.
We could almost buy it, Dan.
You and I?
We almost could, yeah.
Yeah, well, I hear NPR give out big bonuses this year. Everybody got paid.
Right.
You know, the market is essentially saying there really is no value for the common shares. In other words, there's still $15 billion of value, but given the amount of taxpayer money that's come in, the potential losses, Market has sort of spoken.
Yeah, there's $300 billion supporting $15 billion in value. I mean, that sort of says it all right there. All right, quickly, it appears that the market is predicting no turnaround in financials globally for at least 3 more quarters. That's what these numbers look like to me. Secondly, we seem to be looking at something pretty unprecedented here, and that is as China seems to be financing America's stimulus package, and, debtor nations around the world are financing Europe's stimulus packages. We're looking at a situation where all currencies are going to start declining at the same level. And I'm just wondering what the implications are for Main Street as the value of all financial assets just kind of floats downward.
Well, it means that if you can't afford to go to Disney in Florida, you might consider Euro Disney in Paris if the, if the Euro is going to start crumbling. Look, we haven't had any modern experience with a kind of global deflation, right? What we're talking about here is the value of currencies of the developed world falling, or the value of our financial assets, namely our stocks, but also housing. You know, there's a housing bubble in Europe just as there was here, and that's coming out. So we haven't experienced anything like this since the early 30s, and I'm loath to make too many comparisons to the Great Depression, because our policy, the Federal Reserve, the fact that we have a new president now instead of after 4 years of these problems, you know, makes that analogy not hold up so much.
Well, at the very least, there are fewer levers to pull, and so Barack Obama can only really do so much as he weighs in on this crisis. Thank you so much, Dan Gross, senior editor at Newsweek. He joined us from Connecticut. Now, Mark Garrison has the headlines.
Okay, it's 39 minutes after the hour. Today is President Obama's first full day as president. Last night, he and the First Lady attended 10 different inaugural balls. The first dance was to At Last, performed by Beyoncé at the Neighborhood Ball.
At last, my love has come along.
Etta James, of course, made the song famous, and Beyoncé actually plays Etta James in the recent movie Cadillac Records, so it was kind of an interesting choice for the singer. She teared up as she sang. She got a huge response from the crowd, and the family seemed to approve as well. Party's now over. President Obama starts with a prayer service at Washington's National Cathedral. It will be the first time the service is led by a woman. Reverend Sharon Watkins is delivering the sermon. Also today, President Obama will meet with his financial team. He'll also huddle with the National Security Council and U.S. military commanders in Iraq and Afghanistan. The president says he wants combat troops out of Iraq and a greater effort made in Afghanistan. Senator Ted Kennedy will likely leave the hospital today. That's according to his doctor. He says the seizure Kennedy suffered during the inauguration lunch was probably due to fatigue. The 76-year-old Massachusetts senator spent the night at the hospital for observation. He had surgery and treatment for a brain tumor last year. Shares on Wall Street fell sharply yesterday. The Dow fell more than 4%. S&P did even worse. It was a record for an inauguration day drop. And that's the news.
Well, thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udogian. As we've noted, President Obama has already gotten to work, and one of his first orders of business, the new president has asked for the military trials of terrorism suspects at Guantanamo Bay to be suspended for 120 days. Today, that request will be heard by two judges. For reaction, we turn to Walter White, the international human rights lawyer who practices in London, and he's also a former chair of the human rights section of the American Bar Association. Good morning, Walter.
Good morning.
So what are the implications here? Is the Obama administration one step closer to shutting down Guantanamo Bay and ending the Bush policy?
Well, I think that's true, but I think the initiative this morning is really a major step by the Obama administration to take control of the prosecution and the evaluation of the detainees in Guantanamo. It will require a separate order to shut down Guantanamo, but of course, before you shut down Guantanamo, you need to know what you're going to do with the various people there. And this is an effort, I think, to regularize the prosecution of those that they think that they can convict and dispense with those that they think they don't have sufficient evidence to proceed against. But by having a 120-day stay, they have the ability to figure out what they want their policy to be on each individual without having those cases just simply continue to run.
And we're talking about roughly somewhere around 250 detainees, from what we understand, still there. Let's talk about what would happen to those whom they believe they have enough evidence to bring charges and prosecute.
Well, the absolute answer is not clear on that, but there is an expectation. The president, when he was president-elect, and before, has suggested that he would like to bring those detainees onto U.S. soil and presumably prosecute them utilizing the jurisdictional facilities that are in place in the United States. That would mean that they would have greater access to rights and liberties. Of course, they also would be exposed to a very sophisticated prosecutorial capability.
And we've heard a little bit about that plan and some of the leaks by the transition team in reports in the last couple of weeks, and so clearly we'll have to see how that unfolds. But in terms of international reaction, this has been a point of contention, a point of criticism of the United States, the way that the detainees have been held at Guantanamo Bay. How do you think that begins to alleviate some of that tension, international tension?
I believe that the goal of the president-elect is return the United States to the moral high ground. He doesn't want a situation where his administration would have to apologize for how it administers justice, quite honestly, to anyone. And the potential is that the Guantanamo Bay situation is likely to be a major stain in U.S. history, not unlike or not dissimilar to the Japanese internment camps during World War II.
Walter White, we thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Walter White is an international human rights lawyer practicing in London. I should add he's actually in Washington, D.C., and was there for the inauguration yesterday. He's also the former chair of the human rights section of the American Bar Association, talking about the next steps for the Obama administration when it comes to Guantanamo Bay and the detainees there.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 21st, and Mark Garrison is here with the headlines.
Thank you. 48 minutes after the hour, Iraq now says it's willing to let U.S. troops withdraw before 2011. That's the departure date former President Bush and the Iraqi government agreed to. Iraqi forces would then take on full security duties themselves. Later today, President Obama meets with senior military commanders to discuss the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan. Congress approved seven of President Obama's cabinet nominees yesterday, but Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has to wait. Texas Senator John Cornyn delayed the vote. He said he's concerned about foreign investments in Bill Clinton's foundation. The approval is ultimately still expected to go through just after a bit of Senate procedure. Treasury Secretary nominee Tim Geithner will be in the Senate today. His confirmation hearings begin later. They were delayed after Geithner disclosed that he failed to pay certain payroll taxes several years back. He has since paid up. A Judiciary Committee vote on Attorney General appointee Eric Holder is also planned. If he clears that, Holder would need a full Senate vote to finally become Attorney General. The Israeli military says its pullout from Gaza is complete, but troops remain on the Israeli side of the border. They're prepared to take action in case of militant fire. Meanwhile, the UN has called on Israel to allow border crossings in Gaza to be opened, and so food and construction materials can get in. More job cuts are on the way. The world's biggest mining company, BHP Billiton, announced yesterday that it's cutting 6,000 jobs around the world. That is a full 6% of its workforce. Employees in Australia, Chile, and the U.S. will be hit hardest. Also news of 800 jobs cut at Warner Brothers.
Thanks very much, Mark. Yesterday, we saw a sea of faces witness the inauguration of President Barack Obama. And here's the voice of one of them, Tracy Rousey from Elberton, Georgia.
I guess I felt I was on the mall today. It felt almost spiritual. You know, we were singing Lean On Me and Amazing Grace. And I don't know, just brought tears to my eyes because everybody was hugging each other and singing and dancing to keep warm.
Today, tens of thousands of those people are now heading home, and we're joined by two reporters who were following some of them. Josh Rogers is a political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio, and Ben Calhoun reports for Chicago Public Radio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Josh, I understand that you were on a plane with some folks from New Hampshire all the way down to Washington, and what were they talking about, and how did they feel about how yesterday went?
Well, most of the people that were on the plane were elected officials from New Hampshire, and they were all, quite excited at the prospect of regime change, but also of, Barack Obama's election, and they were hoping that, they could roll up their sleeves and help the then president-elect, achieve his ambitions. And, I've heard a lot of the same of that last night, that, they were, overjoyed and moved by what happened yesterday, but knew that resolving some of the issues that that face the country and making Obama's agenda real will take a lot of hard work.
Josh, that's how they talk in New Hampshire: regime change, right? Yeah.
They do.
Yes, indeed.
And Ben, I gotta say, I think you're a little more ambitious. You actually got on the bus with some folks from Chicago and drove to the inauguration. Who were the people that you were following, and tell us about their experience and what you were struck by most?
Well, this was a bus trip organized by Congressman Danny Davis's office. There was a demand in Chicago for people who, people were looking for a way to get to D.C., an affordable way to get to D.C. And so Congressman Davis's office took this on. They started with two buses, and demand was so high, they ended up with 10 buses and two vans for overflow. I have to say I was struck by the sense of ownership that people making the trip had. Something I heard from so many people was, I just want to be there to be a part of it, to say I was a part of it. And to me, it just signals a certain level of sense of ownership of a very public moment.
And you talk about how, when you dug a little deeper in talking to some of these people, that there really was this intense complexity behind their notion of civic engagement.
Yeah. There's sort of that the blanket sense that you get, that people, I want to be a part of it. They sense the historic nature of the moment. But once you drill a little bit further down, they've all got, separate reasons. I talked to one woman who, has been struggling with breast cancer. She is working through an HMO system. And so she told me that she was, she feel health care is, her top concern. And she felt compelled to come here. And, her hope for, changes to the nation's healthcare system was behind that. Other people wanted to come here with their families because there were historic, narratives in their families, and they wanted to be here with their parents. There's just everybody has a different storyline that ties them into the moment.
And Josh, you describe watching people crying as President Barack Obama was speaking. What was he saying at the moments that they were the most touched? And what was going through your mind as you're observing all of this?
Well, where I was at that moment, I had been on the mall and had left to buy a pack of batteries and then could not get back on. And so I ended up taking in the speech from the lobby of the Human Rights Campaign, sort of gay and lesbian rights group. And it was a very interesting place to watch the people when he spoke about, being inclusive and, treating everybody equally. Everyone in the room was very moved, and there were a lot of people holding hands and, tears in their eyes. And, a great sense of relief that the Bush administration was leaving.
And do either one of you get the sense, having experienced this day with people and observing them, reporting them, and them watching them, that it's more than just celebrating the history of the moment, that there is this sense of a possible long-lasting effect on them and a call to responding to that call of action from Barack Obama?
Well, we'll see. A lot of people I talked to last night, I was at a ball that was jointly hosted by New Hampshire and South Carolina, so-called Grits and Granite Ball. It was kind of an interesting mix culturally at the party. But a lot of people I spoke to said that they were overjoyed and dancing and drinking and so forth. But they also said that they hoped that they had what it took to respond to the president's call for engagement, and they hoped that America had the attention span to move through and be excited and be engaged, and not just on the day he was inaugurated, but in the years to come.
Ben?
And on my end, I would say that I'm really curious to see what numbers come back from that National Day of Service that they called for. I've heard that they're trying to take some of the vast field organization that they built, as part of the campaign, and transition this into a service operation in the years to come. I've talked to some people in different parts of the country that I've been in touch with, and they're trying to do that actively. And with this day of service, I'm curious to see whether or not they're actually able to make that transition, and then beyond now, whether or not that has longevity, if they are able to do it in the short term.
Well, I've talked with a lot of Obama volunteers, and they don't want to stop working. They still want a cause.
I think there may be
something to work with there.
Josh, Ben, did either one of you get that sense?
I did get that sense, and I was speaking with somebody who was telling me about the way in which even a lot of the groups chosen to march in the parade were chosen, that a lot of them, the sort of the culling process in terms of who got to march and who didn't, a lot of that was, had a sort of almost a service component and groups that had achieved, tangible things in their communities. And a lot of the people I talked to said that they, intended to remain fully engaged. It's certainly not uncommon in New Hampshire various presidential primaries to kind of, keep plugging along, at least on the political front.
Until the next primary there in New Hampshire, as we know.
Yeah,
always put you guys on the map. Josh Rogers, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Josh Rogers is a political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. And Ben Calhoun, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Ben Calhoun is a political reporter for Chicago Public Radio. And just want to get you up to date. The Associated Press has just reported that a judge said okay to President Obama's request to put on hold for 120 days all military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay.
Just one of the things Obama has to deal with on his first day, and maybe he'd appreciate hearing some of your worst first day on the job stories.
My first day in New York, taking the subway with the company on the way to a presentation, my job was to hold the slide projector, get down to the train, and all of a sudden the case where the slide projector was in opens up and pieces and material all over the place. That was my first day on the job.
And did he have a second day? That's what I want to know. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org for your stories. And an Inside the Beltway takeaway.
Whether the first big test is over the Gaza, over Iran, over North Korea, or over an incursion into the Pakistani territories, I can't tell you. But I can tell you this. Each one of them is going to take a shot and see how he reacts.
Non-allies reacting to the Obama presidency. That's David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
So you saw this yesterday. Here comes the chief judge.
I, Barack Hussein Obama,
do solemnly swear
that I will execute the office of president to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute.
Would we call this Roberts Flub revenge? Back in 2005, Senator Barack Obama voted against Roberts' confirmation as Chief Justice. As president, Obama said he didn't blame Justice Roberts for flubbing the oath of office. Rule number one, counselor, don't annoy the judge. Rule number two, don't embarrass the president in front of 2 million of his closest friends. There's your takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 21st. And, John, that was certainly a memorable moment from yesterday, among so many memorable moments.
A rich moment. Good morning, Adora.
Good morning, everyone. Today, President Obama is still without a Treasury Secretary. Where the jobs are in America, we have a story on that. And also the story of the father of the atomic bomb, J. Robert Oppenheimer. Those stories coming up. First, these headlines.
At this rate, he'll be attending 1,000 balls in his first 100 days. Barack Obama finished off day one as president by attending 10 inaugural balls with the first lady. They did a mean two-step.
I want to dance with the one who brung me, the love of my life, who does everything I do except backwards and in heels.
Very nice. So this morning, a prayer service at the National Cathedral in Washington is on the agenda, and then the president will host an open house in his new home. After that, he'll go to meetings on the economic stimulus bill and the situations in Iraq and Afghanistan. He got some work done yesterday as well. One of his first executive acts was to halt all pending regulations from the Bush administration.
He also suspended military trials at Guantanamo Bay. A military judge this morning, not long ago, gave the okay to the suspension this morning that delays the trial of five men charged in the September 11th attacks. The Senate approved six members of the Obama cabinet yesterday, but Secretary of State nominee Hillary Clinton is still waiting. Republican Senator John Cornyn demanded a first. He wants debate first. He's still expected to be approved today. She is. The Israeli army says it's all out of the Gaza Strip. The temporary ceasefire does not include any arrangement about border crossings. They are controlled by Israel. UN's humanitarian chief, John Ging, says all of them should be fully opened.
I hope that that's the next step. We've had a very narrow corridor of aid coming in. We now need to focus our attention on how to get the big crossing point at Karni open, because, of course, the needs here are massive.
He says construction materials are needed in addition to food and medical supplies.
30 minutes to go before the open on Wall Street. Yesterday was rough. The Dow fell more than 4%. It starts trading today at 79.49. Asian markets had a tough day. Japan and Hong Kong's main indices both fell more than 2%. Wall Street looks poised to bounce back a little bit this morning, but we'll know in the first 15 minutes of trading. So good morning. You have a new president, and he's got a lot to deal with on his first day. So we wonder if he'd appreciate any stories from your first day on the job. And we've heard some actually pretty harrowing stories that Barack Obama might sympathize with, facing two wars and a global financial meltdown. Tell us the worst things that happened on your first day on the job at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Remember the first day we went on the air? Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Explosion?
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. As President Obama looks through his office window there in the Oval Office and thinks about the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, what are the models for dealing with his colleagues on Capitol Hill? Is it a bully pulpit kind of thing that Teddy Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan did so effectively in dealing with legislators? Is it an attempt to go over Congress and use public opinion to strong-arm them, as Bill Clinton did with mixed results? Or is it a murky behind-the-scenes combination that Lyndon Johnson did very, very effectively in the 1960s to get broad legislative initiatives passed, including the Civil Rights Act, which may be partly responsible for Barack Obama being president today? There are many options for Barack Obama, and here to talk about what the landscape must look like to him this morning is David Herzenhorn, reporter for The New York Times. He joins us from Washington. What do you think the executive-legislative relationship is going to look like, David?
Well, good morning. It's going to be fascinating. I think you're hitting the right history when you point to the Johnson administration, partly because no administration in recent history has come in with such deep knowledge of Congress and how Congress works, not just because President Obama served as a senator, albeit for less than one term, but of course Vice President Biden has been a senator for decades. And so they have a lot of friends on Capitol Hill They know how the place works. Now, what's interesting is they also know that that means to get things done effectively, you do need to use the White House as a bully pulpit and sometimes, you know, push really hard, cajole and convince and pressure when necessary.
What are the early signs that legislators, and particularly in the Senate, you use the example of the Senate, are likely to use aspects of complex aspects of, say, the stimulus package or the situation in Iraq to grandstand and slow things down and make this relationship not as smooth as it might be?
Well, look, there's a division of powers, right? The Congress clearly views itself as the Constitution provides, as a co-equal branch of government. So they're not about to bow over even to a friend in the White House. And with the Democrats controlling both the Senate and the House, clearly Obama has a number of friends in both chambers. That doesn't mean that folks won't work very hard to make their policy points known, to make their agenda known, and so he'll be working closely. He already is on the economic stimulus, for instance, with both the House and the Senate, and has reached out to Republicans, although they haven't been brought in quite as much as they'd like just yet. So it's about to get really busy on our end of Pennsylvania Avenue.
Let's look at the House for a moment. The ascendancy of Henry Waxman from California, does that mean that a sort of Waxman program will be shadowing Barack Obama as he begins his administration, initiatives like maybe more serious regulation on things like tobacco?
Well, I think what it assures is that he won't be shadowed by a John Dingell program, which had been trouble for some congressional Democrats. Obviously, Mr. Dingell, the most senior member of the House, a powerful lawmaker from Michigan who was a strong ally of the Detroit auto industry. So with Congressman Waxman now in charge of that committee, what I think you'll see is a very powerful partnership between the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, fellow Californian, and an array of other Democrats who are very intent on making that energy committee a place to focus on climate change and global warming, on, you know, a host of energy issues, you know, foreign oil dependence, et cetera. So I think what you're seeing is in many quarters, and, you know, sort of the preparations for a very, very aggressive, busy agenda.
And let's talk about foreign affairs for a moment. There was a lot of discussion during the campaign about the withdrawal from Iraq, the ending of the war. Do you see Congress and Barack Obama seeing eye to eye on the Iraq conflict and possibly even Afghanistan?
I don't think there's any question about that. President Obama, during the campaign, you know, was clearly articulating what had become the mainstream Democratic view on the Hill, the need for a withdrawal from Iraq, for a renewed focus on Afghanistan and the war on terror. If anything, you know, his perspective may change now that he's the commander-in-chief, now that he's responsible for the troops that are on the ground in the most direct way. You know, that's where I would be looking to see some adjustments. But the Democrats are pretty clear in Congress about what they'd like to see, which is, you know, a slow, steady withdrawal from Iraq and a shift in focus.
And, of course, this week the first order of business is all of the cabinet secretaries and the nominations that need to be advised on and consented to by the Senate. We're going to get to that in just a moment. But, David Herzenhorn, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Talking about the broad legislative agenda as Barack Obama takes office, David Herzenhorn, reporter for The New York Times.
And right there at the top of his agenda, of course, is the economy. And President Obama's nominee for Treasury Secretary, the current chairman of the New York Fed, Timothy Geithner, begins his nomination hearing today. But there's a bit of a cloud after Geithner disclosed that he made errors on his tax return 7 years ago and only made amends after the potential Treasury Secretary job came up. Some think those problems are serious enough to preclude him from taking the job. To understand these tax issues, we turn now to Don Williamson. He is an accountant and chair of the accounting department at the Kogod School of Business at American University. Good morning and welcome, Don.
Good morning.
So,
thanks for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. Essentially, there are several issues. There's a question about taxes on his income from the IMF, a misuse of a dependent child care credit, and a nanny problem. Now, given that he is someone who we're looking to become Secretary of the Treasury, are these just accidental mistakes, or should we be expecting more from him?
Well, I think we'll see a lot from the hearings. I think they start today when he's asked, why did he file his returns this way, and did he understand the law when he filed them? As you pointed out, in 2001 and 2002. He self-prepared his returns and did not pay self-employment tax on his wages from IMF, and also claimed these dependent care credits that clearly he was not entitled to. So I'm curious to see what his explanation will be, other than simple ignorance of the law, when the senators interview him at the hearing today and tomorrow.
But really, is it a question of ignorance, Don? I mean, when I was in law school, I actually clerked for the IRS because I thought I was going to become a tax attorney. Haha, clearly not. But however, I remember someone there telling me, one of the chiefs, that the tax code is so complicated that if you audited every single taxpayer in America, there would be problems on every single return just because the tax code is so complicated.
Oh, that's correct, Adore. I believe there are good faith errors made on many returns, and Mr. Geithner had some. We see this in the facts presented. It's just a question of degree and intent. So what was his state of mind when he filled out these returns? Did he have honestly believe he was entitled to these deductions and payments that he made, or was there something else in his mind when he did these things?
So then how would you describe his behavior based on the fact that you haven't actually seen these tax returns nor talked to him or his tax preparer when that person came into the situation?
Well, it's a little troubling, and again, these facts will be brought out in the hearing, but you look at 2003 and 2004, he had those returns done by a professional preparer, and the professional preparer made the same mistake regarding the estimated tax payments, or their failure to be made, as he did in the earlier years, 2001, 2002. The tax return preparer pointed out to him that the credit for dependent care for the camps that he sent his children to was not permissible, and the accountant didn't claim that credit. But Mr. Geithner didn't file amended returns. In his defense, there is no legal requirement that you have to file an amended return. When you filed the original return, you had a good faith belief you were correct, but then was subsequently pointed out to him that he was incorrect.
So do you think essentially that this, because we're making we in the media or the members of the committee in Congress are making too much of a deal of this when you consider we're trying to give him a job where he will be overseeing billions and billions and billions of taxpayer dollars?
Well, it's certainly embarrassing because to me I find it a little difficult given the facts that he signed a statement, Adora, saying that he understood his responsibility. When he got employed by the IMF, he signed a statement, and it was released to us, that he signed a statement saying he understood his responsibility to pay the estimated tax on his IMF salary because the IMF was not paying the tax on his behalf. He signed a statement. It's there in black and white. So he acknowledges he knew what his responsibilities were when he filed his tax return. Now we say because the law is so complex and so intricate that he can be excused from that. So that's a difficult conclusion to make.
Okay, tell us one thing we need to be listening for as we're watching the hearings today.
Well, the determination is intent. Really, what was his state of mind? What did he know, and when did he know it? Regarding when he filed his return, did he know that he had this responsibility to pay the estimated tax, and either in good faith, negligently, even recklessly disregarded the rules? Or was there something more nefarious here?
We'll be looking for that, Don. Don Williamson is a Washington, D.C. accountant and chair of the accounting department at the Kogut School of Business at American University. Thank you for joining us this morning.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. So on the first full day one of Barack Obama's presidency, what's job one?
Hi, this is Lakeisha from Newark. The first thing I'd do as President Obama is to get Chief Justice Roberts an English reading tutor.
That's a good one. Bad day for Justice Roberts yesterday. Today might just be a bad day for President Obama as he thinks of all the things he has to do now. He'd appreciate some of your worst first day on the job stories. Tell us your worst first day on the job at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
With unemployment up across the country, many Americans are now on the job hunt. And when considering places to work, Rapid City, South Dakota, and Idaho Falls, Idaho may not jump out immediately, but maybe they should. A new study presented this month at the U.S. Conference of Mayors projects staggering job losses in cities like New York and Chicago, but much more stability and sometimes even job growth in 33 other smaller places. Joining us now is Demetra Nightingale, professor of public policy at Johns Hopkins University, to talk about where the jobs are and where they are not. Good morning and welcome, Professor.
Good morning.
So we should add to that list Ithaca, New York, Fairbanks, Alaska, and St. George, Utah. What do they have? What's happening in those communities that are mitigating them from the financial meltdown?
Well, to some extent, if you think about it in terms of smaller towns, smaller labor markets, they have a smaller base on which you're going to start. There are also a few other cities that look like the economy is still doing okay or even growing, despite the very widespread recession. In many parts of Texas, for example, in the McAllen area, Laredo, and in many Texas communities, and also in Grand Junction, Colorado, one of the areas that is continuing to grow in jobs may be the energy sector, and so that may be one factor that cuts across these communities.
And what's interesting, though, is noting that there are jobs in some communities. It's not your expectation that we're going to see a lot of people moving from, say, New York or Chicago to one of these smaller cities because of the host of issues that exist in this meltdown specifically. Explain that, will you?
Yes, I think, well, certainly there are many of them. We know historically in the U.S., people are reluctant to leave their home areas. They're reluctant to leave their families and their support systems. And this is particularly true today, I think, where many families have two workers, not one. So if you think about it, if one of those two workers has lost their job, the family may be very reluctant to leave the one job that they still do have. So they're not going to give up two jobs.
Well, Professor, how do you distinguish, if you're in that precise situation, between a market that is experiencing real growth even in this downtime and maybe a market that's sort of lagging the bottom, that basically you're entering a market where there are jobs now, but maybe in a year or two there aren't going to be?
Right. And I think the opposite is also true, that the labor market is dynamic. So there are always jobs coming and going. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm particularly interested in following is sort of the prospects over the next year or two with the economic stimulus plan, which will include funding that might accelerate the return of some jobs in those communities and also use some of the funds that are in the current economic stimulus proposal that would provide retraining for new jobs. And some of those new jobs are likely also to be in the areas of energy, whether it's related to biofuels or ethanol or wind or solar power. And also the other growth area that we haven't mentioned is healthcare, which even during the recession, there are growing demands for healthcare occupations.
And wouldn't another issue then also be whether some of that bailout money or federal aid goes to propping up the housing market also? Because you've pointed out that can be a problem. If you can't sell your home, then you can't move.
Yes, that's right. So even if people wanted to move, it would be difficult today to move for those who own homes. Of course, not all workers own homes, but those who do are strapped in terms of their options if their primary economic asset is not convertible into cash and not allowing them to move.
Hmm. So you know, what?
They talk about, you know, when there's a gold rush, it's the guys who sell the picks and the axes who make all the money, not the people who actually get the gold. I'm wondering at what segment in, say, the stimulus package you see the most growth. Is it in consulting and administrative sort of oversight of the programs, or is it in actual, you know, working the shovels?
Well, the proposal that is currently on the table would have a little of everything, including what's particularly relevant for this discussion is money for retraining, both for extending unemployment insurance for those who are unemployed, but also providing resources for retraining for some of these new jobs and some of the jobs that are expected to be growing over the next year or two. And that's a way to sort of shift from those who may have lost jobs in the manufacturing sector to regain the skills that they need for the growth occupations. One of the important aspects of that will also be income supports while they're in training, because unemployed workers, parents, whether they're in one worker or two worker households, can't afford to not have income coming in while they get some more education or training. And so in addition to the training would be some income supports to help these families weather the down economic period and also prepare for future jobs.
Demetra Nightingale, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Demetra Nightingale is a professor of public policy at Johns Hopkins University, and she's certainly given people a lot to think about as they're not only looking for a job, but trying to deal with their home, whether they're renting or whether they need to sell. Given this type of market, there are a multitude of issues, but fascinating the bottom line, which is that there are 33 communities, smaller cities in the nation that are actually, they have stable job markets and may even be increasing their employment. Now we turn to Mark Garrison, who's got the headlines.
Thank you. It's 28 minutes after the hour. Now, the Obama inaugural speech, of course, was heard around the world. But if you're watching in China, you missed a little bit of it. Here's how it was covered on state-run CCTV. You'll hear Obama and also the translator.
Recall that earlier generations faced down fascism and communism.
Wait, communism? Oh, okay, wait. So here the translator, they're supposed to, like, fade or down, like, oh, no, we got to go back to the anchor. He said communism, and then basically the anchor's like, oh, what do I do? What do I say? And so finally you basically hear the anchor just coming in and saying, what? Oh, okay, yeah, someone back like that. So basically China, they censored that as well as another reference to suppressing dissent. The government translation omits it entirely. The speech was broadcast live, but the China TV just had to censor it. Obviously there's a long history of China censoring U.S. officials. They scrubbed a Cheney speech in 2004 of references to political freedom. Now this morning, President Obama will attend a prayer service at the National Cathedral. Reverend Sharon Watkins will deliver the sermon. She's a Protestant from Indiana and the first woman to lead the service since it began. That's your news.
Thank you very much, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. All right, close your eyes, blink. Now open again. What do you see in the presidential portrait on this first full day of the Obama administration?
Hi, it's Larry in Manhattan, and I just want to say that let's celebrate the fact that we have not only an African-American president, but we have a biracial president. The perfection of what Obama represents, the bringing together of all people. Let's look forward to the acceptance of all of humanity, not simply black and white, but everyone, through his leadership.
Well, you can see a lot of humanity if you open that portrait to not only Barack Obama's face, but all of the people in his family. You've got Obama's Kenyan step-grandmother, Michelle Obama's great-grandfather, who was born into slavery, Obama's Indonesian-American half-sister, and a rabbi. Joining us to talk about the very new and interesting family portrait that now occupies the White House is New York Times reporter Jody Kantor, who has a French page story on the new first family, and she joins us from Washington. Jody, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, it is interesting to even imagine what the walls of the White House look like today and how different they are from what's happened in the past. What do you think the narrative is here?
Well, it's just such a radical break with the portraits of first families past, overwhelmingly white, overwhelmingly Protestant, Catholics pass for exotic in the hall of that portrait gallery. And yet here you have the Obama family. At one point in the story, I just listed all the different languages they speak, and I won't bore you here with the list, but suffice it to say, we're not just talking French and Spanish here. We're talking, you know, African tribal languages. We're talking Gullah, which is the Creole language of the South Carolina Low Country. This is an amazingly diverse family that is multiracial, it's multi-religious, and their geographic span is incredible.
You know, the radicalism of the change, you're not suggesting that they need to do anything with the window treatments in the White House there in the short term, are you?
No, and, you know, the one thing to say about the radicalism is that, in a way, it's not very radical at all, because the country has always been amazingly diverse since the United States was founded, and yet that was never quite reflected in our ruling class to the extent that African Americans and Jews and Asian Americans made it into the leadership of this country. It was in judicial roles, in staff roles, in Congress, but we have never had the White House has been strangely impervious to the diversity of this country.
And that's an interesting point that you make in your article, and I just can't tell you how many emails and calls that I got from not only here in the U.S., but from my family in Nigeria and in Europe. I mean, as an African-American woman, there was such joy, and I was surprised by how much joy there was among the members of my family and my friends. And as an African-American woman who's also biracial, I've got a lot of those same mixes in my family. And there was this collective joy about seeing that portrait, about seeing that family at the White House as they were walking to watch the parade.
You know what's kind of funny is that this is not actually the first family to have some diversity in it, but it wasn't always handled well. Do you remember when the first President Bush raised some eyebrows when he referred to two of his grandchildren, who are Hispanic on one side? He referred to them as the little brown ones. and people just felt a little uncomfortable about that. And this is, you know, the Obamas take the opposite approach. They really celebrate, in a way, you could say that President Obama's entire political brand is built on this image, because Dreams from My Father is all about coming to terms with this multifaceted identity.
You know, looking yesterday at the television pictures, and again, the most compelling pictures were the shots when they were just walking together, either as the extended family or just Michelle and Barack. It's a merging of this traditional American diversity with this sort of Camelot moment that is very much associated with aristocracy, very much white. But the merging seems really seamless as you look yesterday.
Well, I think what is so important about that is that, by some definitions, the Obamas are an extremely traditional family. Part of what's interesting about the contour of their life is that President Obama especially came from what was a fairly fragmented, unstable family. I mean, he was, you know, he obviously had, his childhood was not a traumatic one, but it really could have been. I mean, his father really disappeared. And, also there was a tradition of multiple marriages at once.
Maybe that's the thing that binds him to Americans the most.
Family.
Everybody's
family
is dysfunctional in America, you know?
Well, it's not so much dysfunctionality as you know, if you look at the fact that even his dad did not always end one marriage before starting a new one, that, you know, that was very untraditional and a little bit unstable for him growing up, and that he didn't have a father he could rely on. And, Barack and Michelle Obama chose to create a very traditional family life for themselves. You know, if you look at the portrait of them with their little girls and also with Marian Robinson, Michelle's mother, living in the White House, you see that this is a family that, you know, it, on one level feels very familiar to Americans.
Right. One final thought on Michelle before we go. You know, someone was talking to me yesterday watching the inauguration that, you know, as a hospital administrator, she probably has forgotten more about healthcare policy than Hillary Clinton ever knew, which, you know, she's a real been in the swing of things, and yet she's taking a very traditional first lady role at this point.
I think that's absolutely right. I've done a lot of reporting on her hospital career, and you're right. She knows a lot about things that are very connected to the healthcare debate. And I'll give you just one example, which is that she's worked a lot on the issue of why people end up in the emergency room for primary care, even though that's not really the right place medically, and it's certainly not the right place cost-wise, because it ends up being a real tax on the hospital system and the public. She has, you know, so far sent out signals that she will play, that she will not sort of directly engage in policy. She hasn't taken an office in the West Wing. She hasn't joined any of the sort of policy working groups of the new administration. But I would be shocked if she did not put that knowledge to use somehow.
Well, Jody, at the very least, it's going to be a resource in the new administration. Jody Cantor, thanks so much for joining us. Jody Cantor is a New York Times reporter with a front page New York Times story on what the first family portrait looks like. It's a radical departure from the past, and with a radical departure from the present. We've got Mark Garrison with the headlines.
Okay. Coming up on 20 minutes before the hour, a military judge has agreed to President Obama's request to suspend one war crimes trial at Guantanamo Bay. Hours after inauguration, the president filed motions to suspend all proceedings for 120 days. His administration wants to review the trial process before they go forward. Later, a judge will consider suspending the case of five men charged in the September 11 attacks. U.S. Central Commander General David Petraeus will be in Washington this afternoon to meet with President Obama. He's coming back from a visit to Pakistan, Afghanistan, and other nations, Petraeus says. He and other top commanders will meet to talk about Iraq and Afghanistan. The U.S. military says it's investigating an Afghan news report that a coalition operation may have killed several civilians. Afghan government officials say their investigation found only militants dead. Yesterday, coalition forces said nearly two dozen militants had been killed in a nighttime raid. And that is the news.
Thanks very much, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckabee. Barack Obama has asked for the military trials of terrorism suspects at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center be suspended for 120 days. So the question for Rob Watson, BBC defense and security correspondent, is does this move make it more or less likely that any or all of those suspects at Guantanamo are going to be brought closer to civilian courts in the United States or sent into more of a netherworld? Rob Watson joins us from London. Rob?
Well, I guess that depends on whether you want the long answer or the short answer. I mean, the short answer to your question is more. Look, this is undoubtedly, as expected, the first clear step that Guantanamo is about to be closed down. But of course, what we don't know at this stage is how, and there are really two key problems which we don't know the answers to yet. The two key problems are, number one, who do you want to actually put on trial? Which of the 248 detainees do you want to put on trial, and who do you want to put into another pile to release? Now, of course, that still leaves other questions, which is, well, how do you prosecute the people that you want to prosecute, and how do you release the people that you want to release?
Is there a core of defendants at Gitmo that might be obvious candidates for going into federal court?
There are, in the sense that I think there's pretty broad agreement that there are a number of people who really are pretty serious, and that there is evidence against them that would stand up in trial. Of course, there is a complication there, and that is, in the case of some of the defendants, or I guess one should call them potential defendants, You know, there's an allegation that some of the evidence has been obtained by torture. So, again, you have a problem there. But the kind of figures that I've heard, we say that there are about 248 still left in Guantanamo. The kind of figures that I've been hearing is there are about 150 or so that should be released or might be released. And that, I guess you can do the math, that leaves you with the other people right. for either prosecuting or doing whatever to.
How do you think the Obama administration is to deal with the fact that one way or another, defense attorneys for the Gitmo suspects are likely to want to turn any resolution of their cases into a trial of the Bush administration itself and be much less concerned about each individual case?
Well, look, I don't think there's any doubt that the Obama administration would rather put behind the acts of the Bush administration, but behind it. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Indeed, Barack Obama, in interviews before his inauguration, made it clear that he didn't want his administration to be about chasing after what the previous administration done in any form or shape whatsoever. But, I mean, it's difficult to see how, in particular trials of some of the individuals being held, that defense lawyers wouldn't, of course, try and make as much capital as they could out of the way some of the evidence was obtained.
You know, I actually love your long answers, but we have only time for a short one here. Is there any way for Barack Obama to re-examine the military tribunal process and deliver a judgment that says, you know, this didn't work right, without handing an argument to the defendants that says, oh, so if Barack Obama says that wasn't right, we can sue on the basis that this went south?
Well, the short answer is I'm not a legal expert. I think it's fair to say that the military tribunals, that the nail is in the coffin, they're gone. What's going to replace it and how will it stand up to defense scrutiny? Well, that's the challenge that the administration faces, isn't it?
Right, and how much liability will be created as the Obama administration attempts to rewrite the rules at Guantanamo. Rob Watson, thanks so much for joining us. Rob Watson, BBC defense and security correspondent, talking about how Barack Obama has suspended military trials of terrorism suspects at Gitmo for 120 days, a possible prelude for a complete rollback of the entire Gitmo process.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, January 21st, and Mark Garrison has the headlines.
Thank you. It's coming up on 48 minutes after the hour, and this just in, Toyota beat GM in global car sales last year. That's the first time the Japanese automaker has ever beaten the Detroit giant, though, of course, it's cold comfort in this tough time for car makers. The Israeli military says its pullout from Gaza is complete, but troops remain on the Israeli side of the border. They're prepared to take action in case of militant fire. Meanwhile, the UN has called on Israel to open all border crossings with Gaza to allow food and construction materials in. Former President George W. Bush is back in Texas at his final news conference. He talked about how he would spend his time after the White House.
I'm a type A personality. You know, I just can't envision myself, you know, the big straw hat and a Hawaiian shirt sitting on some beach.
Can't envision himself, and he didn't do it. He's not at a beach. He's at the ranch in Crawford. He said his plans for this morning, among them making coffee. And later on, he could write a book. Who knows? Doctors say fatigue is behind the seizure Senator Ted Kennedy suffered yesterday at an inaugural lunch. He was reportedly awake and talking with friends last night. He's scheduled to go home this morning. Senator Robert Byrd also left early, but in Byrd's case, aides say health was not a factor. Iraq says it's willing to let U.S. troops withdraw before 2011. That is the departure date former President Bush and the Iraqi government agreed to. They'll take on security duties themselves, the Iraqi troops. This just before President Obama meets with senior military commanders today to talk about the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan. Newspapers were big sellers the day today after Barack Obama was elected to the presidency. Today for our inauguration is no different. There were long lines at newspaper stands around the country. Many papers printed extra copies and some cashed in by printing out inaugural editions today as well.
So kind of old media. succeeded as well as new media. Thank you, Mark.
Well, that's good. Old and new, both succeeding. Okay, now we're going to turn to a story about a new film about J. Robert Oppenheimer. He was, as many of you recall, the father of the atomic bomb and is considered one of the 20th century's most influential thinkers.
If Robert Oppenheimer could not be trusted with the nation's secrets, who could be? Brilliant, proud, charismatic, a poet as well as a physicist, Oppenheimer had seemed to enjoy the full trust and confidence of his country's leaders. He was a national hero, the man who had led the scientific team which devised the atomic bomb. The ultimate weapon of mass destruction.
The story of Oppenheimer's dramatic rise and fall is told in a new film, which you just heard a bit of, and it's called The Trials of J. Robert Oppenheimer. We're joined now by the writer, award-winning producer, and filmmaker who put this together, David Grubin. Welcome, David.
Hi.
So essentially, this is a story about a very dark chapter about American history when, ultimately, a brilliant scientist was betrayed by his government, right?
Indeed, it asks the question of how could it be that a man who had served his country so well and was an advisor to the highest levels of government, a national hero, why did his country turn on him? Not only take away his security clearance, but humiliate him and so badly that strip him of his dignity in a trial that left him a shell of the man he was before.
And let's explain. It was the 50s, and he was the target of anti-communist sentiment, accused of essentially having communist sympathies. Why?
Well, that was really the pretext. Oppenheimer's wife had been a communist. His brother had been a communist. And Oppenheimer, although no one has ever been able to prove that he himself was a communist, he certainly had communist friends and sympathized with many communist causes during the 30s, as did many American intellectuals during that during the time of the Depression. But he himself was not a communist, and that became a pretext for this trial. It was really a political battle. It was a battle between those in the government who felt that the only way to protect the country was to build more and more and more nuclear weapons. And Oppenheimer was a voice for moderation.
And he was plagued, as you described him, by the contradictions that his major scientific development of the atomic bomb brought about, but then also the absolute destruction of the atomic bomb. Let's listen to how he describes it.
We knew the world would not be the same. Few people laughed. Few people cried. Most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
David, his voice sounds tortured. For him, it really was a moral and scientific debate.
Well, here's the interesting thing about Oppenheimer. Those lines that you just heard are very moving and incredible to see him deliver them. He speaks those lines many years after the 1945 test of the bomb, and he's describing the first test at so-called Trinity at Los Alamos. The interesting thing is that at the time, Oppenheimer really didn't anguish over the bomb, and he didn't say this at the time. Oppenheimer had only one goal at Los Alamos, and it was to see if the bomb would work. And that's what he really anguished over. He got into the whole business of trying to create this bomb because the government and the scientists feared that the Nazis were going to get the bomb first, and they were determined to create this bomb before the Nazis did. And that soul-searching anguish really didn't come at the time. When the bomb test went off when it exploded. The first atomic bomb exploded in the deserts of New Mexico. Oppenheimer never said those words. All he said was, "It worked," and he said that with great relief.
Although they knew at the time that the war with Germany was essentially over and that the bomb would only be used against people who were really no threat to the United States anymore, it's interesting to me how someone with such moral regret and a genius could be so blindsided by this Washington effort to utterly discredit him. Why do you think he missed it?
I think he was somebody who was so plagued by his own doubts, by his own doubts about himself, combined with a kind of arrogance that he was ripe for the picking there. It's a tragic moment in his life because he was so brilliant, and yet he had so much self-doubt that he wasn't sure of himself, and they picked him apart.
You describe him as brilliant, proud, and charismatic. That was the clip that we heard at the top of this segment. How do all of those things go together with that self-doubt that you just described?
Well, when you see the way he grew up as a child, he was so precocious. He was preternaturally brilliant, and his parents raised him in a kind of hothouse atmosphere, kept him separate from other children, and he couldn't relate really to other children because he was so brilliant that it took him a long time to have what we would think of as just normal social interactions.
I mean, he found that normalcy in, ironically, the place where the bomb went off first, in the deserts of New Mexico, where he had his own real moments of peace, and yet that began what really was his undoing.
Fascinating, isn't it, that the only time that he really felt those doubts went away was when he was working on the bomb project. And as you say, the irony is that that bomb project led to this tremendous burden that he carried after the war of having been responsible for the bomb.
Well, David, I'd like to thank you for joining us this morning. David Grubin is a filmmaker, writer, and producer, and I'd like to remind folks that his movie, The Trials of J. Robert Oppenheimer, produced by our partners at WGBH in Boston, is part of a brand new season of The American Experience. It begins Monday, January 26th.
But Barack Obama begins today. It might be a bad day for the president as he thinks about all the things he has to do, so maybe he'd appreciate hearing some of your worst day on the job stories.
My first day on the job of a small public interest law office in New York City coincided with the first day that Corazon Aquino was to be president of the Philippines, and I was thinking of her a lot and happy that my challenge was less arduous than hers. I got to the office, and the entire staff was standing there, and somebody said, "We were robbed last night, and all the computers are gone." And I thought, oh, my God, this is my first executive challenge.
She was wishing to go to the Philippines at that moment. 877-8-MY-TAKE for your story, or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now, when you do your taxes on April 14th, it would be helpful to ask yourself, think about this now, what would Tim Geithner do?
Really, what was his state of mind? What did he know, and when did he know it? When he filed his return, did he know that he had this responsibility to pay the estimated tax, or was there something more nefarious here?
Congress will get to the bottom of it. That's your takeaway from Don Williamson, Washington, D.C. accountant and chair of the accounting department at the Kogut Business School at American University. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.